It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We are in prime rhubarb harvesting season for Wisconsin gardens, and a master gardener is here with tips on how to twist and pull up those stalks and gather an armload. Enjoy rhubarb in a variety of recipes like this one, rhubarb custard streusel pie. You can find it at WPR.org/mornings. Call in with your questions, comments about rhubarb, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Becky Gutzman is a master gardener, previously worked as a nutritionist for UW Extension. Becky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I'm happy to be here.
So why is rhubarb a common vegetable seen in Wisconsin this time of year?
Well, it's a seasonal vegetable, so it comes up in the spring. It's perennial, which is one of the things I love about it. I don't have to plant it. And it is only harvested in May and June, generally. So this is the time of year that people are thinking about it and wanting to use it. It's at its prime right now.
So you grow rhubarb enthusiastically. I'm going to just call you the Wisconsin ambassador of rhubarb. We're going to lean into this.
But you, that's good.
You give presentations on it. What do you find special about rhubarb?
Well, the fact that it is a perennial and comes up by itself is very appealing to many people. It's also a very pretty plant with those big leaves. It's a nice decorative accent in your garden. Some people even grow it in amongst their other perennial flower beds because it's so pretty. One of the things that people often ask me when I talk about rhubarb is it done when the flower stalks come up? I can't pick it any longer then? And that is not true. Hmm. You should actually pick those flower stalks off or cut those off because they don't serve any useful purpose. And they actually tell the plant to stop growing. I'm done now. I've flowered. And we don't want the plant to stop growing. So cut those flower stalks off and then your plant will keep producing. This hot, dry weather we've had the last few weeks has been a little hard on rhubarb plants. So I know my plants are very grateful for the thirsty drink they got yesterday.
So what about those leaves, though? They are toxic. What should we be aware of?
They are. They contain oxalic acid, which is a mild poison. So in the spring, if your plants are growing and we get a hard frost, those leaves will be frostbit, and that drives the oxalic acid down into the stalk. So you don't want to use a stalk that has a frozen or a frosted leaf on it. I just cut them off and toss them in the compost bin because they become unsightly once they've been frozen. But that's the only real concern, is you don't want to eat a stalk that's been frosted on the leaves. And so in the fall, sometimes we pick rhubarb again because the cooler weather and the fall rains kind of revive the plants. Hmm. And that's fine to do. It won't hurt the plant at all. But when that first frost comes, then you're done. Don't pick any more rhubarb after that either.
So is it okay, though, to eat the stalks of rhubarb that are only partly red with green on the upper half? Or what about the red in the stalks?
Yes. The color is very indicative of the variety of rhubarb that you have. And so the good old-fashioned rhubarb that all of our grandmothers had in their yards has a big, thick, green stalk. It's the most vigorous of all the rhubarb varieties. And the stalk has very little red on it. That's fine to use. I have to tell you a funny story. One day I was making rhubarb sauce, and one of my kids came in the kitchen just as I was dropping a few drops of red food coloring into it. And they were like, "What? Mom, are you cheating?" I said, "No. Did you think this rhubarb sauce was red naturally?" So it doesn't have as nice a color when you cook it. But now we have a lot of newer varieties of rhubarb that are much more red in color. They aren't necessarily any sweeter, though. Some will advertise that they are, but I have not found them to be discernibly sweeter. But they sure look nicer when you cook them in a dish. The downfall in my mind of the newer varieties, the really red ones, is they're not as vigorous of a grower as the old-fashioned types. So you'll have to have a lot more plant to get enough to make a cake and a pie and rhubarb crisp.
Talking about rhubarb with Master Gardener and retired nutritionist for UW Extension, Becky Gutzman is here. You can join in with your questions about rhubarb, your comments, what it's like to grow it for you. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Becky, what should a person look for when picking out rhubarb at, say, their local farmer's market?
You should look for nice firm stalks that are not limp. That means they've been picked too far ahead of time. And often at the farmer's market, and sometimes even in the store, you will see a little bit of leaf left at the top, an inch or so. Most harvesters do that in order to just keep as much of the stalk fresh as possible. When you get home, they'll cut that top leafy part off. You don't want to use that. I also think it's best if you find rhubarb that has the stump end, it's the leaf petiole, still attached at the other end. That means that it was pulled from the plant, not cut. And from a grower perspective, that is healthier for the plant to pull that stalk off. If you cut it, you leave a cut edge for disease or insects to enter. When you pull it, that's just a natural sheath around the base of the plant and it comes loose and doesn't hurt the plant at all. So when you are looking for it in the market, if you have that lower rounded part attached, then you'll have a complete fresher stalk. When you get home again, you'll cut that bottom part off and discard it. But a nice firm stalk that has good color. And of course, if you see any insect damage, you don't want those.
Are there any pests that get into rhubarb or that we should be aware of when you talk about insect damage?
Yeah, that is really the beautiful part of rhubarb. Not very many pests like it. There is a rhubarb borer that sometimes can get into your rhubarb plants. And generally, that only happens if you're growing it in a poor location, like a low damp area or
Okay.
in too much shade. Rhubarb really loves to be grown in full sun and it likes great drainage. It does not want wet feet at all. And so if you're growing rhubarb in the right location, will hardly ever be bothered by any insect or disease pest.
So when you said that the twist action on the stalks, do you kind of twist and pull for
I
optimal for
do.
the plant? And then the follow-up to that is how many stalks to leave at the harvest to ensure you have that future production if you want that rhubarb to come back in a vigorous way?
So I grab the stalk fairly low on the stalk and just twist and pull it away. And generally, it'll just snap right off the plant. So I would say don't take more than a third of the. Well, let's back up a little bit. If you have just planted a new rhubarb plant, don't pick any stalks the first year. It really needs to establish a good root system,
Okay.
putting energy into more stalks. Even the second year, just a few stalks. By the third year, it should be well established, and then you can pull more. But I think in any season from any individual plant, I wouldn't pull more than a third of the stalks at one time. But the rhubarb plant will keep growing and keep sending up more. So you'll get more harvests off of it, but you want to be a little bit not too overly enthusiastic with picking the stalks all at once.
Nice,
We
easy
have a friend
scale up.
from Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Was
we had a friend from Texas who was up one time pick and wanted to pick some asparagus for his take home because they can't grow or rhubarb, I'm sorry, rhubarb there. It's just too warm for it. And I said, oh, sure, go ahead. And I was at work. And when I came home, there was hardly anything left to my bed,
Oh,
but it was an
dear.
old established bed and it bounced back just fine. So it's those first few years, be gentle on it.
Wisconsin Master Gardener and rhubarb enthusiast Becky Gutzman, getting us better acquainted with this plant. And you can join the conversation along the way about harvesting and using rhubarb in your recipes. Call in with a question. You can share your gardening experience here at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how to harvest and cook with rhubarb as Wisconsin rhubarb patches provide the early fruits of the summer season. Join in about the tart stalks of a rhubarb plant, what you wonder about harvesting and cooking it. The number to join in with a question or thoughts, 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Master Gardener Becky Gutzman is here. So, Becky, we got wind that you have been a county fair judge for a half century, judged nearly every county fair in the state. How many rhubarb pies do you think you've tasted along the way?
Well, you know what? Not too many, because May and June are really rhubarb season. And by the time I'm judging at fairs in July and August, fresh rhubarb is not being picked anymore. And that's an interesting thought. You know, you can freeze rhubarb so easy. Just rinse it, cut it up, put it in a Ziploc bag and freeze it in a freezer bag. But when it comes out of the freezer, it's quite watery. And while that works great for sauce or in a cake, it's not the best for a pie. So I don't see a lot of rhubarb pies, amazingly.
The timing is not quite right. Interesting. So,
on the other hand, I've made a lot of rhubarb pies.
And that's really where we want to go here. What makes a good rhubarb pie?
Well, interestingly, when I first got married, I made a rhubarb pie like my mother made it, a two-crust pie with a nice rhubarb filling thickened with flour or cornstarch. And my husband was like, never saw a rhubarb pie like that before. His mother made a single crust rhubarb custard pie with a tall meringue topping on it, which was also wonderful. So I would go back and forth between his mother's pie style and mine. But this year, I have found a new recipe that I'm really enthusiastic about. But back to your question of what makes a good rhubarb pie, first of all, a tender pie crust. So I just think everybody should learn how to make pie crust. It is so simple, and it's just so tasty. So a good pie crust, a filling that doesn't run all over your plate when you cut into it. So rhubarb is a hard thing to thicken. Apples, just a little bit of flour will thicken that up fine. But rhubarb needs a stronger thickener. So either use cornstarch or mix a little tapioca with the rhubarb, and that will make a better filling that stands up after you cut into the pie.
I'm curious about your pie being kind of a standalone rhubarb pie without its favorite match being strawberry with it. Like, do you have to cut the tartness at all in your pie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. If you have straight rhubarb, it will take more sugar than if you're mixing it with those sweet strawberries. I think rhubarb strawberry pie is a little bit more modern than the pie that my mom would have been making 50 years ago. That seems to be a really popular combination right now.
So if someone just doesn't really appreciate rhubarb like the way you do, what is their on-ramp? What is like their gateway to rhubarb and winning them over?
Well, probably using it in a dessert that has a lot of other sweet ingredients. There's a lot of crisp and cobbler recipes out there that might call for a cake mix in with it or a sweet topping. When you have a lot of straight rhubarb, even if you've added a lot of sugar, you really get that tartness through more when there's more rhubarb. But, you know, scientifically, there's a difference in people. Some people never taste that tartness, and other people one bite makes their jaws lock up.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you might not ever convert everyone to be a rhubarb lover.
It's kind of like the cilantro effect.
Yes, exactly. It's probably the same gene that does that.
So how do you judge how much rhubarb you actually need for a recipe, especially if you're not used to using rhubarb in a recipe?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would say that a pound of rhubarb probably yields about 2 cups of chopped rhubarb.
Okay.
And so, you know, when I'm picking it out in the garden, I'm not weighing it, and I'm not buying it in the store where it's measured out and said so much per pound. So I just pick stalks until I eyeball it and think, oh, will this make about the 4 cups of rhubarb that I need for this recipe? Mm-hmm. Of course, I can always go out to the garden and pick one more stalk if I need it. So I think, yeah, that's a little bit iffy, but just try to eyeball it and see if you're at a cup or 2 cups.
And earlier we were talking about thinner stalks versus the thicker, more mature stalks.
Mm-hmm.
Is earlier rhubarb and those thinner stalks more flavorful and tender versus, what is different about the thicker, more mature stalks?
Well, thicker and more mature doesn't always go together.
Huh.
Some plants always put up bigger, thicker stalks. It's just their variety.
Mm-hmm.
Some varieties always throw up, that sounds terrible, put up small, skinny stalks. So don't worry about the thickness of the stalk as much as does it seem firm but not tough. And then just pick as many as you need to make your amount.
Talking about rhubarb with Master Gardener and retired nutritionist at UW Extension, Becky Gutzman is here fielding your questions about rhubarb, 800-642-1234. Okay, Becky, it is time for pie. You provided us with this homemade rhubarb pie recipe, rhubarb custard streusel pie, and we have a link to it at wpr.org/mornings. Tell us about this recipe.
Oh, I think this one is great. It just uses a single crust, so that's less daunting for people. You roll out your crust and put it into a pie plate and crimp the edge. You chop a couple cups of rhubarb and put over the bottom crust. The custard is wonderful and easy to make. It uses 4 egg yolks and some sour cream and a little flour and sugar, of course. You pour that over it and bake it for about 25 minutes. Meantime, you're going to make a simple streusel topping with sugar, butter, and a little brown sugar and a pinch of nutmeg. And a pinch of nutmeg is just what it sounds like, what you can hold between your thumb and your index finger as you pull it out of the container. But that nutmeg goes so well with rhubarb. At 25 minutes, you pull the pie out and sprinkle that streusel on top. And I like to cover the edge at that point with a pie protector so it doesn't get too brown and put it back in. And to know when it's done, stick a knife near the center. And if it comes out clean, that pie is done, even if it's still jiggly when you wiggle the pie plate. And it'll finish setting up as it cools and then refrigerate it before you serve it. It is so good.
Oh, my goodness. And that nutmeg twist sounds really just really wonderful. What about the room temperature sour cream in the recipe? How long do I leave it out and, you know, so it's still okay?
Yeah. A half an hour is plenty.
Okay.
And it just that sour cream and the egg yolks and the cream all call for being room temperature. It just helps that pie start to cook a little faster in the oven if they're not straight out of the refrigerator. So keep that in mind. If you're really in a hurry and you don't have time to let it come up to room temperature, the pie will take a little bit longer to bake. That's all.
How did you come upon this recipe?
Oh, I'm always searching various cookbooks and internet sources for recipes, and I was looking specifically for a single crust rhubarb pie. I just thought that would be the thing to do, and we love streusel in our family. So when I found this custard pie and then put a streusel topping on it, I thought, this is a winner, and so far, everybody has agreed.
So we only have a few moments left here, but let's say you've won over some people on rhubarb and they're thinking about planting it this fall. What makes a good spot for a rhubarb patch?
It should be in full sun, and often put it on the edge of your garden so that you're not having to till or shovel around it. And rhubarb does not like weeds. It doesn't like to be crowded. So mulch around it and keep the weeds away. Don't plop it in the middle of the lawn and let the sod encroach on it. It just won't grow as vigorously for you. So a good sunny spot where you can mulch it and take care of it.
Oh, Becky, thank you so much for joining us. Happy gardening.
Thank you. I love gardening.
Oh, Becky Gutzman, rhubarb enthusiast, master gardener, previously a nutritionist for UW Extension. We have a link again to her rhubarb custard streusel pie recipe at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about bird watching.
There's a certain point every spring in Wisconsin when it seems like winter is finally gone for good. We put our heavy coats away for the season, trees and flowers begin to bloom, and as WPR's Bridget Bowden tells us, we begin to hear songbirds welcoming warmer weather.
Early May is an exciting time for many Wisconsinites. There's a feeling of optimism in the air, knowing sunnier days are ahead. And it's prime time for bird watchers, like Carrie Hagenow, who I met up with at Wyalusing State Park.
This is where the Mississippi River and the Wisconsin Rivers meet, and we're up on what's called the Wisconsin Ridge Campground, so a beautiful bluff overlooking both the Wisconsin and the Mississippi.
Hagenow works for the Nature Conservancy and is an avid birder. She comes here every year around this time just to catch the migratory songbirds as they make their way north from their winter homes.
These birds are migrating from as far as, you know, central South America, so thousands of miles, and they're looking for breeding grounds. So they're singing, they're trying to attract mates, they're looking for food. This is a great place with all this forest cover to look for food. And, you know, some will stay here and breed, and some are just passing through all the way up to the northern parts of Canada.
As we stand on the path under the trees, she tells me what she's hearing.
Okay, so we got two birds that just chimed in here. Biz, buzz, buzz, buzz. That's our golden winged warbler. And then we have a black-throated green warbler he's got a similar buzzy sound, but he's like zo-zeet, zo-zo-zeet.
Birding with Hagenow is all about listening.
Like 90% of my birding now is like listening to what's going on around and then being like, okay, I know what this is. I know what this is. Ooh, I hear a black Bernie and I want to see him because he's gorgeous. And then when you hear something that you're like, I don't know what that is, that's when you kind of seek that out too.
But sometimes the birds give you visual clues too. She spots a flash of color high up in the trees.
Let's see. I saw kind of where he flew up, but I didn't see where he landed.
It's a scarlet tanager, one of Hagenow's favorites.
So it's a, I'd say, robin-sized bird. Bright red. And I say that like a cardinal is red. And this is like someone flipped the lights on the cardinal. That's the one, too, that has the song that can sound similar to a robin or a rose-breasted grosbeak, but they do this chick-burr, chick-burr. And when you hear them do that, you're like, oh, okay, scarlet tanager, gotcha.
The scarlet tanager was the first bird that Hagenow identified on her own when she first started birding. When she saw it, she added it to what birders call the life list.
A lot of people, when they get into birding, they start keeping that list, right? And it's always fun if you hear somebody say, I got a life bird. It means it's the first time they've ever seen that bird anywhere.
After all that excitement, there's a bit of a lull. Hagenow says the birds calm down in the heat of the afternoon. But she says that's the nature of birding.
You can know right where that bird is, and you just can't get a good look at him. And you can sit there for a long time, and it's just not going to happen. It is. It's a game of patience. It's kind of like hide and seek or a scavenger hunt, right? Because you just never know what you might see.
while loosing in May might be the prime time and place for birding. But Hagenow says anyone, anytime, anywhere can enjoy looking for birds.
You know, that birds are one thing that no matter where you are, you can find them. And they're going to be different everywhere, but you can go in New York City and find birds, right? Or you can come here where it's forested and you're up on a bluff and there are birds. The truth is, any time of year at any location, you can go out and look at birds and appreciate birds.
WPR's Bridget Bowden brought us that story on birdwatching at Wyalusing State Park. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A bipartisan nationwide group focused on building trust in elections and access to the polls, it launches a chapter here in Wisconsin. Keep Our Republic, it is named, was formed in 2020. It operates in the battleground states of Pennsylvania and Michigan as well. Call in with questions and comments about the work around election integrity, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Bernier is state director of Keep Our Republic, former Republican state senator and former Chippewa County clerk. Kathy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How does this organization address your interest in increasing public trust in the election process?
Well, it comes down to education. We want to build the knowledge base of stakeholders and individuals throughout the state to understand the electoral system, that much of the information they've received in the past couple of years is not exactly accurate.
How do you do that? How do you build the knowledge base and help people understand what the system is?
Well, each one of the states have created a plan that suits them, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Seeing as how that I believe that the closest people, the closest government to the people are the local governments, their counties and municipalities, and they're the ones that actually run the elections. So I want to involve county clerks, municipal clerks, and other individuals, people in the local schools, law enforcement, other individuals to attend meetings around the state. And so if you educate those individuals who are, you know, always engaged with the community around them, that they can help educate others as well.
How do you envision, though, as you do this work around the state, how do you envision your work parlaying with the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is working to build trust in elections and carry out the election system and working with the county clerks? How does that work with Keep Our Republic when, you know, the commission is also doing this work?
Well, you know, we're not going to do it in a vacuum. Megan Wolf and the other individuals that work in the Wisconsin Election Commission and I have worked hand in glove for 12 years. So they know that I will contact them whenever possible and even ask them to attend if they would like to. We are just, you know, developing our layout of our educational program. So I will have others assisting me. As a matter of fact, and in about a week, I'll be attending the County Clerks Conference and soliciting their help in educating the public. So I won't be doing it on my own. We will have a panel of knowledgeable people there to educate and answer questions.
Wisconsin joining Keep Our Republic chapters, Pennsylvania and Michigan in it as well. All three are considered battleground states in presidential elections. How might our state's involvement in a national election integrity organization affect voters in the 2024 presidential election?
Well, I think that they understand that our mission isn't partisan. We don't care who's on the ballot. We just care that the election goes off is carried out in a most legal and professional manner and the most transparent. Sunshine is a great disinfectant, and the more open we are about the electoral processes, the better off everyone is. And so, as soon as you try to pull away or hide what you're doing, or be defensive, I guess is what I've seen. You know, when poll workers and clerks are asked questions, sometimes they get a little defensive because it's, you know, a lot of those questions are asked in a accusatory manner. But I think as long as we're open and transparent and educate individuals on the process. As a matter of fact, at one of the meetings I attended not too long ago, I suggested that we go ahead when a poll worker is doing something, that they announce what they are doing. You know, it's a kind of an experience I had back when I was a CNA. You tell the patient, I am going to turn you here, I'm going to move you there, so that nothing is a surprise. And so I think the more transparency we have, the better off we are, and people should be able to understand and respect the process.
So really telegraphing every move in the process for the clerk being a step forward you would see in the process and in helping transparency.
Correct.
You know, as a state senator, you were very vocal and criticized fellow Republicans for spreading false claims that Donald Trump had won re-election in 2020. How do those claims continue to sow distrust in the election process?
Well, they just do. With that said, I think that I wanted, you know, being the chair of the Elections Committee, the goal was to go ahead and review and wait for the audits. Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty did an audit as well because they wanted to make sure that the election results were correct. We had the Legislative Audit Bureau auditing election results. And then, of course, the Wisconsin Election Commission audited more, a larger percent than what they usually do of the electronic voting systems. And so I just really would have preferred everyone, you know, cool their jets and wait until the audits were complete and everything was verified. And it was. And there's also a frustration I had with people who gathered information through public records requests from the Wisconsin Election Commission, and they got the data they wanted, but they didn't even know how to interpret it or what it meant, and didn't really go to the back to the Elections Commission and have them sit down with them and explain what this information is. So it was a very frustrating time, and I just really don't want to see that in 2024, no matter who's on the ballot.
Former Republican State Senator Kathy Bernier is state director of the nonpartisan group Keep Our Republic. You can join in at any point. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, a national bipartisan group dedicated to improving trust in elections. It sets down roots in Wisconsin. Keep Our Republic plans to work on educating voters about how the election system functions in our state and what makes the process secure and trustworthy. You can join in with a question. You can add your comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Bernier is state director of Keep Our Republic. Let's bring in Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi. What would you like to add?
Hey, good morning. I really appreciate this idea of educating the public of what's going on. Have you considered in that spirit of transparency, let's make a documentary, a little mini video of here's the process from start to finish. Here's how to register. Here's what happens to your ballot. Here's where it goes from there. Thanks very much.
Kevin, thank you. Kathy, what about a visual or a documentary type approach?
Excellent suggestion. The executive director, Ari Middleman, and I have actually had a conversation about this, is how to put together a short video or graphic on how to how the whole process works. So thank you for the suggestion. We are on it.
Kevin, thank you. We'll stay tuned. Kathy, the Keep Our Republic Wisconsin Advisory Council you put together, it's made up of 13 Democrats and Republicans. All are former public office holders, including yourself. How will these former politicians work together through the organization?
They're going to help answer questions, disseminate information, maybe have a media appearance here and there. They also will let me, they'll be my ears and eyes around the state so that they can give me feedback on things they're hearing or questions that they have. So it's always good to have as many people as possible out there helping out with the process, because we do have a large state and we have a very diverse state. So I think we have a very diverse advisory council.
What does success look like for you in the Wisconsin chapter?
Success for me, for all of us, is that we have an uneventful election in 2024, that things go as smoothly as possible. As you know, in 2020, we had COVID, exacerbated a lot of issues. We had things that were processes and procedures that were not usual or customary. We had nursing homes that weren't, wouldn't allow the special voting deputies in. We had drop boxes, which we had never had before. So there was various things that were different and called into question. You know, it gave, you know, sort of ammunition, for the lack of a better term, for individuals who did not trust the process, because it wasn't something we had done before. We mailed out a lot of forms for people to apply for an absentee ballot. And the confusion was some people thought they were getting a ballot and not a form to file an absentee ballot. And then some, matter of fact, one individual in Chippewa Falls saved the ballot and showed me she did receive more than one ballot. She received two ballots. And so when that sort of thing occurs, there are errors in all walks of life. Everything we do, people make mistakes. And mistakes can be made and will be made. And to take a mistake that's made and then, or a misunderstanding, and then blow it out to be a statewide problem or a nationwide problem is something we experienced, and we do not want to repeat.
You just mentioned a bunch of ways of accessing the ballot box, and your organization's mantra is let all eligible voters vote. And that seems really clear and straightforward. How does your organization feel about access to the ballot box and laws that make it harder for eligible voters to cast a ballot?
Well, there's another misinterpretation. Every time I worked on laws to yes. make it more clear and accessible, but yet have guardrails. All our processes in government have to have guardrails, as that's what the legislature's for. And so to interpret an election law to be prohibitive is not exactly fair. So we have a very accessible election system in the state of Wisconsin. You can request a ballot on MyVote. You can request one from the municipal clerk, an absentee ballot. And you can go there in person, request an absentee ballot, vote, and cast your vote at the polling place. And Wisconsin and Minnesota were the two states that started in-person election day registration and voting. And so there's really, it's very open, and there's, I don't know how we can make it any easier. And so there is some responsibility of the elector to request the absentee ballot if they need an absentee ballot. And of course, the polls should be open and accessible and convenient as well. So I think we have a good system in the state of Wisconsin. I worked the polls in the 80s. I was a county clerk, and I've never had, in all the time that I ran elections, anyone complain that it wasn't accessible. And that's kind of a mantra right now. And it annoys me a little bit, to tell you the truth.
Kathy Byrne, you're with us, State Director of Keep Our Republic, talking about improving public trust in Wisconsin elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You mentioned the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty's 2020 election report. What information in that report do you hope to act on?
Well, we just want to use that information to just disseminate as far as the facts about the election. One of those facts was, you know, the Republican congressional candidates received 67,000 more votes than Donald Trump got. So it was clear that individuals did not vote for president, or they voted for Joe Biden and then turn around and voted for the Republican congressional candidates. To me, that was like the fact that really convinced me that there wasn't a conspiracy to flip votes or anything like that, because it's the voter behavior that chose who our presidential candidate was here in Wisconsin. And I believe the congressman from the Green Bay area, he received 27,000 more votes in that district than what Donald Trump got. So it was clear to me that the voter fraud, there was not widespread voter fraud.
We only have a few seconds left. Your group is against lobbying for particular bills that will affect how elections are conducted. Why is that?
Well, we're not a lobbying firm, and you have to be careful. Otherwise, we have to fill out all the lobbying stuff. But we certainly can disseminate our opinion on whether we think something's a good bill or not. And so we can do that, you know, quietly with the legislators. But we don't have a position on any particular bills, and we're not going to lobby for or against any particular bills.
Kathy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Kathy Bernier, State Director of the nonpartisan group Keep Our Republic. A Republican, Bernier served for 12 years in the legislature until her retirement last year. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.